Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Welcome back to our podcast series, Mindfulness Where Dharma Meets Practice. This is the 10th podcast in the series and the first of two talks on the topic of living in the midst. Living in mindfulness, we tend to lose me in the task at hand. Living in virtue, to the extent we attain purity, we lose me in concern for the well-being of all. Living in wisdom, me disappears into nature. Living in devotion, we lose me in the practice itself. But how do we not lose mindfulness, virtue, wisdom, and devotion in the midst of the chaos and contingencies of normal worldly life? Setting out on the Buddhist path is like taking a hike with a large and very mixed group of people of every age, state of health, type of footwear, backpack size, degree of inebriation, and so on. Such a group will spread out along the path, with the strongest, healthiest, hiking booted, light backpack, boldest, most persistent, and most enterprising leading the way. In the middle, there might be a mutually infatuated teenage couple that keeps up in spurts but keeps getting sidetracked and disappearing from the path and returning with ruffled hair. Some chubby middle-aged people who huff and puff, along with some fit but ancient bird watchers. Falling way back are parents and their little kids who cannot walk another step, a couple of people sitting on a rock drinking beer, an elderly gentleman watching fire ants devour his cane, and a lady who broke a heel upon encountering her first rock. Similarly, Buddhists, all intent on losing themselves in nature, come with different levels of enthusiasm, aptitude, and opportunity, bringing with them different forms of worldly baggage, and choose among different forms of practice, oftentimes inspired by the accomplishments of the leaders and tales of views from lofty heights. At the beginning of the path are those who add a practice or two piecemeal into already busy lives. This is where most of us start who come to Buddhism later in life. At the higher end of the path are those whose entire lives are practice, for the depth of the Dharma comprehends all aspects of life. This is held as an ideal necessary to reach the highest levels of awakening. This podcast is concerned with how we move as far up the path as possible in the midst of our busy lives. That is, it asks how we view, plan, and arrange our lives to provide the optimal conditions for the Buddhist in us to grow and flourish with time. The Tribulations of the Sunday Morning Buddhist. As we start out, we typically add a Buddhist practice or two to our busy lives, to the externals, that is, to all our non-Buddhist responsibilities, values, pursuits, and so on, which we leave intact. Typical, modern, and valid ways to enter Buddhist practice are through mindfulness-based meditation, through devotional practices, and through reading inspirational texts. Each of these specialized practices quickly provides an inspiring sense of bright and sunny satisfaction and calm, encourages further practice, is rather modular in relation to externals, and demands moderate time and effort. However, this kind of specialized practice has severe limitations for a couple of reasons. First, we have learned that everything we do throughout the day, even if we do not consider it to be particularly Buddhist, even if we do not consider ourselves to be particularly Buddhist, bears on practice, either as right practice or as wrong practice. whether we're aware of it or not, for we are the heirs of our karma, of all of our deeds. Second, each of these practices is fundamentally a support for the rest of Dharma practice. Mindfulness, for instance, is a powerful, multi-purpose faculty whose full power comes from how it is applied. Certainly, this practice cannot become substantially fulfilled except in service of ethics, right view, and refuge, generally somewhat neglected in specialized meditation. Mindfulness without Dharma develops as a powerful, all-purpose faculty, but with limited content to be mindful of. The result of this dedication to a single practice is that practice integrates poorly with the externals of life, and practitioners find themselves thrashing between two modes of being, one rife with stress, striving, and conflict, and the other calm, uplifting, and affording temporary relief from the other mode of life. The practitioner begins to view meditation as a lifeline to something sane in her life and develops a strong attachment to the chosen means of practice, all the while frustrated with overall progress. This is much like the knitter of the first podcast, who watches his partially finished sweater unravel throughout most of the day. With attachment also comes dogmatic and self-involved adherence to one's chosen practice as true Buddhism. In fact, whole schools of Buddhism have developed around such narrow understandings of both meditation and devotional practices. Mindfulness-based meditation, for instance, is often touted as a complete path in itself that leads, with no additional effort, to stronger ethical behavior, better relations, greater wisdom, happiness, and eventually awakening, all possible in the midst of a busy life. Although the single practice provides many benefits and turns quickly to trust and devotion, I have yet to see in others the more profound behavioral shifts generally promised, even in the most dedicated practitioners, without significant changes to other aspects of meditators' lives. Although we're likely to begin focused on a single practice, it's important not to set limits on our practice. Rather, to maintain a more inclusive view of practice, then, where possible, to try to expand the scope of practice even further, even while remaining centered on a single practice. The rest of this talk and next week's talk is about overcoming limits in a practical way in order to integrate practice more thoroughly into our lives in the midst of the externals, and to bring as many aspects of our lives as possible into closer alignment with Buddhist practice and understanding, so that we might progress more rapidly toward awakening. Being mindful throughout the day. Both mindfulness and devotion are kinds of infrastructure in that, like a road or like the internet, their purpose is in the content they convey, and also their usefulness generalizes beyond Buddhist practice. Mindfulness can be thought to bear on the most mundane tasks throughout the day, preparing meals, repairing the car, caring for children, walking to the mailbox. Simply knowing what our task is, keeping your mind there, and doing it competently not only trains our faculty of general mindfulness, which we put to good use in Buddhist practice, but facilitates a satisfaction, depth of experience, and proficiency that otherwise remains elusive in everyday life. It also requires no additional time commitment, is strengthened by our on-the-cushion practice, which greatly magnifies our capacity for retaining mindfulness throughout the day. Moreover, a sense of general uprightness ensues that can be developed as we keep in mind the values enumerated in right intention, renunciation, kindness, and harmlessness as guides in all of our daily activities. We'll further consider devotion in similar terms next week. Overcoming cultural limits. Everyone wishes for a unifying philosophy of life, lest life become fragmented and aimless, one that goes beyond satisfying self-serving urges. Unfortunately, we tend to put unnatural limits on what is acceptable to us in Buddhist practice. This is hardly surprising, for entering the Buddha way is, particularly for the modern person, to enter an unfamiliar land with unfamiliar customs and ways of looking at things. There are many teachings of early Buddhism and still alive in Asian traditions that raise more than a few eyebrows. For instance, rebirth, ritual, the monastic institution, awakening, transcendence of samsara, heavenly realms, and renunciation. Understanding the value of these teachings requires a wide, open mind and often a willingness to reconsider our own tacit presuppositions, which are artifacts of our own culture that we often don't know we have. Sometimes what we attribute to common sense actually has complex origins in the history of Western thought, in Protestant Christianity, in the European Enlightenment, in European Romanticism, in modern consumer culture that have limited alternative ways of thinking for us. In fact, there is a strong tendency for modern Buddhists, upon encountering a novel teaching, simply to attribute it to Asian cultural baggage, thereby dismissing it from the purview of Dharma. This strategy is problematic because, as we have seen, for the Buddha, each teaching serves some function that reveals itself in how we practice, and therefore our practice may be rendered critically incomplete if we leave something out. We should hope that we could rather let Buddhism be Buddhism and try to comprehend the system as a whole, lest our holistic perspective be compromised. The problem here has an analogy in anthropology, in which the challenge is to analyze an exotic culture in its own terms without pretentiously imposing our own modern values and interpretations from the outset. The method applied there entails withholding one's own views about whatever inscrutable elements emerge, a process sometimes called bracketing. Bracketing is somehow what I did spontaneously when I first took rebirth seriously, as described a few talks ago. Even if rebirth makes no sense to us, we can nonetheless continue to explore how it relates to other aspects of Dharma and has implications for practice. We can continue to understand better the cultural context in which it does make sense, and we can continue to understand the influence of our own tacit assumptions according to which it does not make sense. This gives us a lot of wiggle room for eventually integrating this teaching seriously. How we ultimately understand the teaching may never be the same as an ancient Indian understanding, yet can still serve much of the same function. It's always helpful to ask from the beginning, why did the Buddha teach this? Before we ask, is it true? In this way, we start from the perspective of Dharma, rather than from the perspective of our own preconceptions, and sustain a curious, questioning mind. As we bracket aspects of Dharma, we should keep in mind the point made with regard to taking seriously but holding loosely. Our concern is not to be able to say, only this is true, anything else is worthless. Rather, it is to practice skillfully, that is, beneficially. Now, it also turns out that we are all quite adept at bracketing. which is what holding a working assumption is all about. Let's call a tightly held assumption or belief a viewpoint and call an outlook that which informs one's actual behavior as a basis of one's everyday decisions in life. We all routinely hold both, even when they clearly contradict one another. For instance, a Skinnerian behavioral psychologist might believe, viewpoint, in the lab or in the classroom, that human mental states are not real, yet shouts out encouraging motivational words, outlook, to his teenage son as he plays on the school football team, or consoles his little daughter after the dog slurps up her pizza. One might sincerely believe that physical death is the end of consciousness, viewpoint, and yet one treats the remains of one's newly deceased loved ones with great care and respect, having their rotting remains arranged to produce a pretense of peace and comfort, outlook. Many believe that the universe is entirely material, simply playing itself out mechanically and deterministically, viewpoint. Yet none of us knows how to live in such a world. As Isaac Bashevis Singer puts it, you have to believe in free will. You have no choice. Free will is a universal outlook, even of those of entirely contrary viewpoint. How many readers talk to your dog or cat? Outlook. How much do you think they understand? Viewpoint. I personally even talk to squirrels, frogs, and bugs. There is physically nothing more to money than ones and zeros in computer memory or markings on pieces of paper or metal. Viewpoint. And yet we behave as if it is something of substantial value, outlook, and count on others to do the same, with remarkably practical results. In brief, loosen up. What is surprising about Buddhism is how thin metaphysical assumptions actually are in the early Buddhist texts, but not absent. Our presuppositions will be challenged repeatedly, but not so much by contrary Buddhist viewpoints as by the Buddha's record of undermining all viewpoints as illusory and empty of substance. This will carry over to some of the most established, commonsensical Western viewpoints. Right livelihood. What we do for a living is likely to have a particularly significant influence on our practice. For instance, if we interact with customers for a living, we may be required as a condition of employment to stretch the truth a bit. That dress, looks great on you. Or to cook the books, or to set mouse traps, and so on. Right livelihood is the fifth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. For most of us, livelihood is the central extra Buddhist obligation of our lives. We obligate ourselves to fulfilling a livelihood in order to sustain our lifestyle, to feed our family, or to be able to afford opera tickets, fine cuisine, and a luxury car, or to pay off a student debt, or to realize other values or pursuits. The Buddha warned us to beware. A lay follower should not engage in five types of business. Which five? Business in weapons, business in human beings, business in meat, business in intoxicants, and business in poison. Elsewhere he recommends, and what, monks, is the wrong mode of livelihood? Trickery, cajolery, insinuating, dissembling, rapacity for gain upon gain. These sound embarrassingly like modern job descriptions. I myself used to be employed in R&D under U.S. Defense Department contracts. When I took up Buddhist practice and study, I saw I was probably contributing to weapon systems, and this ended up being a major factor for me in ending my high-paid, high-tech corporate career in favor of what I do now. Unfortunately, the modern economy often offers few wholesome choices for the job hunter living under normal circumstances. The radical redirecting of my own career path would have been extremely difficult if I were not at a point in life in which my family obligations were loosening up. If I wasn't designing weapon systems, I might have been working in marketing, trying to convince the public that ingesting some horrid concoction of petrochemicals, high fructose corn syrup, and saturated fats will add zest to their lives. Alarmingly, large modern enterprises typically distribute decisions in such a way that obscure personal ethical responsibility, and workers who are compensated through wages have little control over the products of their labor. A wrong livelihood is one that obligates us to unethical or other behaviors inconsistent with Dharma, particularly by breaking precepts, killing, stealing, lying, and so on. This raises two important questions. If our livelihood requires that we kill, for instance, one, are we really the ones harming others? And two, do we suffer karmic results? That is, does this impair the well-being and development of our mind? After all, the killing is our boss's decision, and if we were not there to act out his orders, wouldn't someone else be called on to do so instead? The Buddhist answer is much like the decision of the Nuremberg trial. We are not off the hook. Orders are not just orders. We are the heirs of our own deeds. In a recent documentary on the health insurance industry in America, a woman was interviewed whose job was to deny insurance policies for pre-existing conditions. She was visibly upset, almost in tears, when she asserted, "When someone comes in, I don't want to be friendly. I don't want to know them. I just try to look at their application." Now imagine how that will bend her character over 5, 10, 15, 30 years. Her livelihood was plainly taking a karmic toll on her already. That is what makes wrong livelihood a detriment to practice. This raises also the question of motivation in livelihood, aside from the paycheck. Some people love their livelihood to the extent that they would engage in its activities even with little pay. Some scientists or historians are like this, some artists or actors, many craftspeople, and horse breeders. These people are lucky, for they inhabit their livelihood. That is, they engage in their life's work devoutly for the sake of their life's work itself, not as a way, or only incidentally as a way, of getting something else out of it. This is healthier from the Buddhist perspective, as we have seen, because greed and fear and its concomitants, like ego involvement, are minimized. Moreover, such people are likely mindful of standards and very proficient and enjoy satisfaction and well-being in their work. They also are likely to be quite successful without the distraction of striving for external goals. It's noteworthy that the Buddha, in advising laypeople concerning livelihood, repeatedly puts emphasis on the way we inhabit our work, on carrying it out in an upright, responsible, and harmless way, on diligence, on proficiency, and on protecting the results of our labor, rather than on getting rich. In the Mangala Sutta, the Blessings Discourse, he extols much learning and handicraft as among the highest blessings. Elsewhere, he also states, "What is the accomplishment of persistent effort? Herein, by whatsoever activity a householder earns a living, whether by farming, by trading, by rearing cattle, by archery, by service under the king, or by any other kind of craft, at that he becomes skillful and is not lazy. He is endowed with the power of discernment as to the proper ways and means. He is able to carry out and allocate duties. This is called the accomplishment of persistent effort. This is to work mindfully and to put aside striving. Unfortunately, many of us find little satisfaction in our livelihoods beyond pay and are kept in a relentless state of insecurity, either because we do not earn enough to support ourselves or our families, or because we are under constant threat of being fired or otherwise exploited. Even the affluent can feel that they are in a perpetual state of desperation when their wealth is threatened or fails to support their status. Such desperation is experienced as poverty, even in the midst of splendor, and is ethically compromising, making greed, aversion, and delusion a matter of necessity. Such a condition provides little basis for spiritual progress. That so many are forced to live under such conditions is a strong indictment about the health of our society.
Further resources related to this course, Mindfulness, Where Dharma Meets Practice, are available at Sitagu, that is Sitagu, sitagu.org/shortlinks/mindful.